Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Charles Blow has been a columnist at the New York Times since 2008. He is known for penning intensely personal pieces, and now he tells his extraordinary life story in his memoir, Fire Shut Up in My Bones. The book explores racial, spiritual, and sexual complexities, and is Blow's coming-of-age story of psychic survival and self-invention. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Charles Blow to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
In the writing that you do as a columnist for the New York Times, when did it become apparent to you that you wanted to write a memoir and you wanted to share it?
Well, I've been writing the memoir longer than I've been writing the column. I started writing not even thinking that I was writing a book. I was just writing personal passages from my life that I thought I might sell to a magazine or something. And I never got around to selling it, and the words kept building up, and it was more and more of my life being committed to the document. And in 2009, I realized that I not only was I writing a book, but I needed to write a book. There was an incident where two separate incidents actually, two little boys, both of them were 11 years old. They didn't know each other. They each hanged themselves 10 days apart, and they had both experienced unrelenting homophobic bullying. And I thought to myself, this can't be. This can't be. Can't happen on my watch. If there's something that I can do, I have to have a moral obligation to do it. And they may not have had the language to say what was wrong, but I do. And I have been to that place of being bullied and feeling like there was no way out and thinking that maybe suicide was a way out. But I had thought better of it and they had not. And that I could sketch out a life, what life looked like if you walked away from that horrible decision. And it may not be easy. And that road may be very rough, but you could have a life. And that no one else had the power and agency over your life to take it away.
Were you at that point at 11 years of age?
I was at that point at about 8 years of age.
And so very much understanding where they,
absolutely,
where they both were.
I not only did I understand, one of the little boys looked remarkably like I did at his age. So I'm looking at his picture and I'm seeing myself.
In the writing of your story prior to that, mm-hmm. you're writing for yourself. And is it a way of working through and understanding, or is it more as a chronicle?
It was just a literary exercise. I had gotten a bug. Someone at Essence Magazine had asked me to write a short thing for their Father's Day issue a couple of years before, and about I was a single dad at the time, and they wanted me to write about learning to do my daughter's hair, and I talked about, you know, having to go with my mom to the hairdressers when I was a kid, and they really seemed to enjoy it. It was very short. It might have been like 200 or 300 words. It wasn't much of anything, and I thought to myself that, you know, I had loved writing when I was younger, and that wasn't my career, but I would like to try again. And I just started writing really as a literary expression. It wasn't about kind of psychological processing. It wasn't about dealing with painful issues. For my part, as best I could tell, I had dealt with them. And this was part kind of emotional archaeology. I had to go back into things to dig them up again, because for me, that was the life before, and this was the life now.
So when you say you had already dealt with that, did you feel that through the process and actively writing the book, did you still feel that way, that you had dealt with it, or then was there a realization that there was more
to
deal with?
I think you really don't know your life until you write your life. And so there was absolutely some of that. And there were connections to be made that I had never made. And once I could see them written, I could make those connections. I also was able to further forgive myself. When you understand and can see in the context of a narrative just how young you are and just how ill-prepared you are to deal with trauma, it relieves even more than I already felt that I had been relieved of kind of feeling like that I was somehow either not necessarily to blame, but that there was some part of this still on my shoulders, maybe. It also helped me to see people as much more human when I had to write about them as human beings and not drawn very narrowly as I had drawn them in my mind as strictly heroes and completely infallible or strictly villainous and with no redeeming qualities, that people are very complex. And I was able to, and I kind of had to, in the writing about these people, to see them as whole. And that was a revelation for me.
In the forgiving of yourself, does there ever come a transference where it turns to anger to another?
I think I had to give up the anger that I had for my abuser, anger at anyone who I felt should have been more emotionally available for me and was not. I had to give that up a long time ago. I think it came to a point where it was going to consume me and destroy me. And people have to deal with that in their own way when they've been the victims of trauma. And some people need to work it through with the person who was the abuser. I did not. I needed to release it. And that worked for me. And I think we have to allow space for each person in their own way to deal with it as they see fit for them.
When you were talking about the two 11-year-olds who committed suicide, and you said you were at that point at 8 years old, you were first abused at 7.
Exactly.
So it's through those weeks after that this all started to become a boiling point, if you will.
Well, it wasn't the abuse, actually. I don't think was the worst of it. I think the bullying by my abuser was the worst of it. The abuse was a one-time event. It was traumatic, make no mistake about it. And it was a colossal betrayal of trust by him. But when I think about it, I think that maybe, I'm not sure if this is true, but I think that maybe I would have been able to survive that psychically and spiritually because it was not repeated. What I could not survive was the torrent of put downs and the bullying that seemed suffocating and irrepressible. And that was what I wanted to escape.
And at 8 years old, what arsenal do you have? What do you have in your utility belt to even deal with that?
Deal with the bullying?
The bullying.
That was the thing. I mean, I think that, I think these sorts of trauma stay with you as an adult, and you think about them with an adult mind. And I had to transport myself back to 8 years old and realize that I was not psychically equipped in any way. And no matter what I did, it wasn't the wrong choice. I wasn't equipped to deal with it. And so I didn't deal with it, and it was eating me alive.
It was an older cousin.
Older cousin, yes.
Who abused you.
Yes.
And the relationship prior to that, how would you characterize it?
Well, he was a distant, he didn't live near us. He lived pretty far away, actually. They rarely visited. So I didn't, it wasn't a close relationship at all. Rarely saw him. And he just came to visit for a couple of weeks one summer.
And it was the bullying after, so there was an expiration date on that when he left.
There was an expiration date on when he left, but I kind of internalized it, and whenever he would come back, that's exactly what he would bring with him. So whenever I would see him after that point, not just for those 2 weeks, but whenever he would come to visit, it would start up again. And so it just felt like this, there was no way out of it for me. And because I started to retreat into myself, it amplified it in a kind of hyper-masculine boy culture where quietness is not necessarily appreciated, but quiet was the only refuge I had. And so the more quiet I became, the more I think other people kind of joined in on his bullying.
You then are haunted by this, and you feel compelled to murder the man who abused you.
Yes, so that's when I'm like 20 years old, and at that point it feels like this event has been with me my entire life, the 13 years between 7 and 20, and every time I feel like I've gotten past it or gotten over it, it some way or another comes back into my life in what I view as destructive ways, and it feels like I'm never going to be able to break free of this. And my mom calls one day. I'm at school, and I went to college very close to home, so it was about 25 miles away or something. And she calls and says, wants to speak to you, and there's a silence, and she... there's a voice that says, how you doing or whatever he says. And I immediately recognized it as his voice. And I hadn't heard that voice in years. And all of the pain of what I thought had built up because of what he had done to me erupted in that moment. And in that moment, I went from just being a sad, probably depressed kid to being a homicidal kid.
And do you look at that moment as rational now?
Of course it's not rational. I don't think that any time that you even entertain the idea of taking a life is rational, but I think it was the explosion of emotion. And I jump in a car and I race towards my hometown, and maybe this lasts 2 minutes, I guess. So the whole episode lasts 2 minutes. And I just decide, I have to make a choice. I have to release this and stop living my life through the eyes of this 7-year-old boy who has been hurt, and say that I am an adult, a man who has agency over his own life and can make his own way in the world and has a future. And that was the choice I made. And that was what was rational, that coming to terms with things and saying, this is not the choice to make. This is not a good choice. This is not, even in the context of your life, it doesn't make sense.
And it's the quiet that wins out.
The quiet wins.
And you become more comfortable then.
Absolutely.
As a quiet man.
Yes. Although some people wouldn't necessarily describe me as quiet these days, but I become more comfortable with myself, and that begins the journey into myself as I am today, and it is its own journey, untangling abuse from attraction and intimacy, untangling my aversion to people who I think may have ulterior motives, and being open to full friendships and full loving relationships. And all of that is part of that journey out of that darkness where I was.
And in the book, there is such a nuanced treatment of your sexuality and the uncertainty of it. And this is all work. It's a work in progress through your life, right? Of coming to terms with that.
I think it's coming to recognize it and being able to articulate what it is and being able to say that it is okay as it is, and that even that it doesn't fit the binary that we are kind of taught to recognize, either gay, straight, or larger umbrella term queer, straight, that it's a spectrum of identities, and it's not a hierarchy. There's no better one and lesser one. There's just different ones, and people can be stationary at different points across that spectrum, and other people can be fluid and move across that spectrum depending on situations and circumstances and the person that they meet and someone who they may be interested in and may fall in love with, and that all of that is part of the human sexual lived experience. And when I didn't have the language to be able to describe that and to be able to claim it and to be able to own it in myself as a younger man, as I grew older, I started to say, this is okay, and this is natural, and this is me, and I actually like this guy. And to be able to accept myself as myself was the liberation.
In the accepting of yourself, does it come with, for want of a better term, a label? Because we seem to want, as you called it, a binary code of having to be able to define who you are and what you are without being worried about what the outside world thinks.
Right.
Was it necessary for you to have some sort of identification?
I didn't think that personally that I needed identification. I thought that I need description, that I need to be able to describe what I was feeling accurately and honestly to people. But I do believe that labels are beneficial, because you can reduce that description. People don't always have time for the 5-minute explanation of how you feel. So to say that I am bisexual, which is a word that I would never use for a very long time, and I because I wanted something that was, something that didn't exist, something that was more personal to me and specific to me, and that was not freighted with negative connotations. And I had to say, Charles, get over it. This word is not only serviceable, but it is sufficient. And no, not everybody who fits under this umbrella term will be exactly like you, but maybe that's the beauty of it, that you will be side by side with people who you'll have to learn a little bit about. And in fact, every identity term is an umbrella term to some degree.
Right. Gay, straight, whatever. Doesn't identify everybody
same way. There are a lot of ways to be straight.
Does that understanding make you, because there has been work that you have done to understand who you are, ultimately make you a more understanding and better writer?
I think that it has increased my level of empathy, and I think that empathy for a writer who writes about people and characters is always good, because you need to be able to do that. But my journey to trying to be the best writer that I can be has not really been about this struggle. It has been more about trying to connect myself to my truest self, meaning not running away from being the poor kid born in the small town in the South who raised the hogs in the back of the yard and had the garden across the street, and where people didn't necessarily speak the Queen's English. And in fact, realizing that that beat and that cadence and that the great storytelling tradition of the South was in fact what made my voice slightly different than the people who I was reading, and the people around me who were writing, and that that was my special thing. And to embrace all of what had informed my life, I think, is what is informing my writing.
And again, back to labels for a moment, and back to those two 11-year-old boys in 2009, that this is very much a story of a poor African-American boy in Louisiana in the Deep South in 1970s, but this story is universal. This can be a rich white kid on the Upper West Side.
Reinvention is a classic, kind of self-salvation and reinvention is a classic literary trope. You could argue that Gatsby is the same concept, and people we revisit this idea. So what I've just done here is just place it somewhere else that feels slightly foreign, because we don't always see, or we don't have literature or movies or television shows about the rural South, the working poor, in places that are outside urban environments. And particularly in African American literature and film, Southern almost became a dirty word. The only time you could write about the poor South was if it was historical, or you could see it in movies if it was historical. It was civil rights movement or before, and it was a clash of races. And this tries to say, there's also, you know, people still live there. If you look at the map of the counties with the largest percentage of African Americans, they still live in the Black Belt of this country, which stretches from about East Texas up into the Carolinas. These, you know, those stories need telling. And this was an attempt to try to touch on that, at least one small slice of that, and give voice to those lives.
In your column, do you feel, and I hesitate to use the word obligation, but mm-hmm. but an opportunity to tell those stories?
I tell them as I can, but it's not, you know, it's not personal narrative driven. It's a different form. It's big idea, big concept. And so I do think of the column, though, as about beliefs, behavior, and biography, that I like to look at opinion polling because I like to know what people believe and why they believe it and what they say. And I like to know, write about how people behave and how their belief systems inform that behavior. And I often use my own biography to get into those things. So I do think of it in that way to some degree. And I do choose subjects that are very close to me. So the fact that I wrote a memoir is very much an extension of the column in a way, because it's a lot of the same themes. It's poor people, hardworking people, vulnerable children, violence, difference. And I write about those things constantly. And that's very much a part of me. And I think that because people come to columns for voice, that it's important that you write about things that where you really do have authority, and that your voice can command passion. And those are the subjects where my voice commands the most passion.
Is it naive to think that there will be a time where we won't read the story about the two 11-year-olds within days of each other who hang themselves?
I certainly hope so. I mean, I think that, you know, the world, again, if you look at opinion polling, the world's becoming much more tolerant, and you see real moves towards equality of all sorts in our society. But I do believe that male culture, particularly when you're young and can't suss out the fallacy of it, can be suffocating. And young boys sometimes can't survive it. And they're aiming for something that they will never reach, because it is unattainable for so many. And it shouldn't be. And I hope that we can reimagine the male identity as very broad and able to fit in everyone who chooses to identify in that way.
Charles Blow's memoir is Fire Shut Up in My Bones. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Charles, thank you so much for sharing with us. I do appreciate it. A great pleasure.
It's my pleasure.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. The show was recorded at Argo Studios in New York City. My thanks to Paul Ruest for his support. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.